Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
You ready? Welcome to the Chemical Science Building. This is a building that we built recently, and let's see if I can drive this thing here. That's the back half, actually. Let's see. The Chemical Science Building was built and handed over to us in 2005, and it was kind of handed over to us in such a hurry that there really wasn't even a startup done on it. Campus people had to do our own startup on a lot of the equipment, and so we got into a building, we turned it on, started teaching class, and we found out this building's not working too well. We did have a monitoring-based project with Cogent on our U-Haul building earlier, and they straightened us out, found a lot of problems for us. And so we recruited Charlotte and her team to help us out. And so we went into we selected for the MBX process, and we found out a lot of interesting things. The building was constructed in 2005, turned over to us. It's a 5,700-square-foot building. Got a lot of lab space in there. It's connected to our central plant, chill water loop. We also connected to, we have a high temperature hot water loop with individual heat exchangers in each one of the buildings. Same goes for this building here. We have redundant pumping for chill water, hot water. We have two air handlers for the lab. With four exhaust fans, the building's basically split in half. We'll see that in a minute. We have two air handlers with 58 VAV terminals for the classrooms and office buildings that are connected. And we have 10 fan coils for IT rooms, elevator switch rooms, all that, and they're all connected to the chill water system. This is our chill water loop. One of the things that we do here is we use the most open valve. It's a campus-wide type strategy that we've adopted on our campus. It's been very successful. As you can see here, we have a nice hot return water, 64 degrees, which is a norm for most of the campuses building. We run a 24-degree delta. So we're trying to get this building to blend into our system, and you'll see in a little bit some of the things that didn't get that for us that Charlotte and her crew found for us. Also, the chill water pump speed is regulated off of the valve positions, and you see right here, right here we're running at a really slow speed. That's pretty much how everything works. Also, here's the most open valve program. It's something that was written on campus. Campus staff actually wrote this program, installed it. How we turn on the pumps. The pumps normally don't even run. They start up when the most open valve gets to about 98%, or in this case, we got 100% here, and it stays there for a while. It's been a very good outside the box strategy thinking. It saved us a lot of power on the infrastructure campus-wide project. This is the actual speed control program that we wrote and put in. This is just some more slides here showing the graphic packages that we work with. We have a tritium-based system with a lot of data. It collects a lot of points. It's all it's on the Niagara platform. We have two air handlers that serve the building. Like I said, it's split in half. There's a damper in the middle here where we can actually, if one is down for service or whatever, that'll open up and one air handle will feed the entire building. This is air handler three, which serves the VAVs and stuff like that. And then we have two exhaust plenums for the laboratory fume hoods. Basically, follows the same ducting with the air handler supply. The exhaust does the same thing. They were supposed to be redundant fans, but we found after they brought the building online, we could not maintain enough static in the duct to keep the fume hoods out of alarm, so they run all the time. We have a wastegate set up over here so that we can see, maintain our stack velocities at the top of the, right there. And all this data we're collecting, it's trending in the system. Typical fan coil unit, which we're looking at here, it's all in our graphic package as well, which is really came in handy for the MBX project because we had all this data that Charlotte and her crew could get together. Here again, a VAV typical. And there's a floor plan, and you can drill into any one of these rooms and see all kinds of neat things. Okay, well, we started up this. We collected up all the block programs that Charlotte needed and her team. Blueprints, we checked out the point lists and analog, gave all that to them so that they can analyze what we had. Here's some of the points. And we also have a lot of complaints from the occupants from day one. We either noisy vents, too cold, couldn't maintain air balancing. Just the building really was just running wild. So what do? We developed a baseline. Here again, using the installed EMS system, which was really good for this. We collected a calculated all the tonnage, developed a relationship between the tonnage and outside air. Here again, we set up the different categories, and we had to extrapolate some data because this building was a brand new building, so we had to figure out what this thing would really look at over a long-term history that we didn't have. And this is kind of some of the data and how we did that. We did the same thing pretty much for the hot water system. Here again, and electrical consumption, we basically the same process over again. And here's what we came up with, our baseline here, which was a baseline that we measured, and then after we applied, looking at the historical data for weather and a few other things, overlaid it, put, ground it all out. And this is what we came up with, an adjusted baseline in this column here. This is just the MBX process overview. I think everybody here's probably been through one of these, or you've heard about them enough where I don't need to go down through all those little boxes. And here we did our point to point. This is a group effort between Cogen staff and our staff. We just basically checking out the system, making sure it's doing what it's supposed to do. And right here we corrected anything like the flow meter I was talking about, some temperature gauges or sensors that were out of calibration, those kind of things. And here's kind of what we found after we started looking into the building at the investigation. Say we found chill water valves and were leaking by the basically valve stroke adjustments, things like that. So we had to get our valves in control, supply air temperature and resets. Basically, the building was running with static reset. There was none. So, and that really was a problem for us, and it gave us a lot of occupant comfort issues. Condominator dampers and sequencing. So, these are some of the things that we were looking at. Chill water, hot water pumps. So what did we do? We trended things. We got a sequence of operation developed. We got it installed. We tamed our trend data. We created our graphs, reviews. This is kind of like just a typical nice night evening in San Bernardino, where we get about, if we're lucky, we'll get down to 88 degrees at night at 2 in the morning. And here you can see, we got a hot water valve that's cycling up and down, but thank God the hot water heat exchanger has a lockout on it, so it's not locking, so even though the valve's actuating, but we do see the chill water valve, it's all over the map here. And we're trying to figure out, why was this doing this when our set point was right here? And here you can see your chill water, your air handler supply temperature bouncing all over the place. Here again, there's a chill water pump that's we're supposed to get our 24-degree delta T, and you can see sometimes we're lucky to see 5 degrees here. Pump's running at 100% the whole time. Well, what we found was this little fan coil in a closet had the valve stuck at 100%, which was telling the chill water pump, I need water. So the chill water pump took off to try to supply it. And we actually froze these guys out because we were well below the temperature set point. And these are the type of issues that we found. So once we got that all done, we had zone presence sensors on our hoods. Some were not connected. Some didn't work. So we got those all fixed. We got our resets in. We got our implemented a low airflow VAV set point. Now, this is kind of an interesting thing that we did. For heating and real cold air with the VAV system, they go to minimum flow. You can't get the heat to go down to where the people are. So when a hot water pump comes on, the VAVs will go to max position so that we can get good airflow in there to heat on real cold days. This did work for us. What did we learn? If you're going to build a new science building, commission it. Because the builder, when he built it and it looked like it and it had a paint job on it, he left. And when we tried to teach in it, it didn't work. Make sure your metering in place is accurate. Learn how to get out of the box to acquire your trends. Now, this was kind of neat. All those data screens that you saw gave us a lot of information, but we couldn't get it out of the server because our server would only allow you to grab little bits of chunks of information at a time. Charlotte's team, when we called Invensys, we said, how can we get into this thing? They showed us how to do an in-run around the program and basically grab the entire database and extract it out so that we can do these big trends. And Charlotte, I remember that day because you were like, oh, yeah, all right. Very happy. And that was really helped the process along to where we could find a lot of this, being able to get all that data out and install it. Problem was, though, when we had all this data rolling into our system, you got to know your limits of your file capacity. We had 20 gig of data, which crashed our system. That's when we learned, hey, you know what? Collecting data is great, but you got to learn to know your, like Clint Eastwood said, you got to know your limitations. So, and of course, back it up. You know, I forgot to tell you what we saved on this thing. So real quick, the project cost $152,000. Annual savings is about $50,000. 3-year payback on that. We saved 184 tons of carbon per year is what this thing translates to. We did not do any fan management like I wanted to do. I was really impressed with Mike's presentation yesterday, and I'm definitely going to pursue the Acuity system, which I think will overlay on our system really well. We can pick up some kWh, because we only picked up 112,000 kWh per the year. Well, our big savings came from basically all that heating and cooling that you saw going on that was going right up these pretty stacks up there. So, and that's us.
It's an opportunity to be here with you to present our commissioning project, which won the Best Practice Award for the UC system. And middle of last year, through the partnership program, we were approached by the program administrators that there are still available funds and incentives to do additional projects. So we went ahead and reviewed our list of potential projects on campus and came up with two additional MBCX projects, and Tang Center is one of them. So I'll give you a background of how we implemented the commissioning project in the building. The discussion I will present to you will start with the project summary, and I'll describe to you why we chose the Tang Health Center building on campus, and I'll enumerate the measures that we implemented for the project. I'll show you some of the verified achieved savings in the building and share with you lessons learned and what we need to do next for the project. So what we did for the campus of about over 100 buildings, we benchmarked and calculated a number of energy uses in each building and calculated for the energy use index. Tang Center is one of our top 20 buildings on campus with high energy usage, so that's why we chose the building. Through the commissioning project, we were able to meter the building, providing real-time metering for gas and electric So we were able to develop baseline models for the energy consumption in the building. One of the things they did for the project is work closely with a controls contractor, and I'll explain why. We haven't had an existing control system in the building, which has failed. For 2 years, it has been running on manual or local mode. So the building was running 24/7. So we decided to go ahead and upgrade the control system using the automated logic system. Through this control system, we were able to identify potential projects and measures and implemented them through energy control strategies. This is the overall result of our project. So combined gas and electric savings. Our target for the project when we applied for the commissioning project is only 15%. And at the end of the project, we doubled that result, combined electric and gas, which is about 105 kBTUs per square foot per year. Although we had a six-month duration for the project, we were still able to look into possible HVAC retrofits, which I'll be discussing, and potentially we can do more work in the building for the 09 partnership program. So what's the building? The building is a student health center, and it's also our backup for campus emergency. It also serves a nearby college, Mills College, so all their students also come to campus for their health needs. It's a 75,000 square foot building built in 1993, so it's about a 15-year-old building, three-story. And if you notice the energy use intensity, it's about 150 kBTUs per foot per year. On average for our campus, it's only about 80. So it's about double. So we focus on this building. There's lots of potential to do commissioning and retrofits in the building. And there are four direct expansion units, four package units on the roof that serves just the interior spaces in the building. The perimeter areas are have operable windows, and for heating, have radiators. The package units have inlay vanes, guide vanes that modulate for economizer. For the heating requirements, the building has a boiler, gas fire boiler. And it's open Monday to Friday, 8 to 6 regular operating hours, and Saturdays from 9 to 5. I mentioned earlier that the automation system has failed, so we've got the building running 24/7 mechanically. So the building has a non-functioning control system, so the economizer operation was not functioning, and there is no scheduling function, therefore 24/7 operation. For the units that were installed 15 years ago, we didn't have enough maintenance programs, so it has to be serviced and maintained with all those four package units. So when we implemented the new control system, the ALC, Automated Logic Controls, we were able to implement these measures, including scheduling. So we were able to turn off the air handling units, the chiller and the boilers at night when they're not actually occupied, the building's not occupied, and on Sundays when the building is actually closed. Another measure that we did was before the supplier temperature was at a fixed set point, so we were able to adjust that supplier temperature. Based on sample temperatures that we have on the zones, we put in the four temperature sensors on each floor as a representation for the building, and also took into account the outside air temperature to reset the supply air temperature. And finally, the boiler blackout. We had instituted a control strategy based on outside air temperature, so the boiler won't come on until the temperature is under 50 degrees. The static pressure for the four package units is at 1.5 PSI. We reduced that to an inch and a quarter, therefore adding additional savings to the building. Here's the tank center electricity use. What we've done is calculate the average daily kWh for the building. So prior to the commissioning project, we developed a baseline period. And from that, as you can see, the building operates pretty much between the range of 4,000 to 6,000 kWh per day. When the commissioning project was implemented and all measures put in place, this is your cutoff here,
You show us, you see a shift in the energy use electrically, whereby the peak or the highest usage was about 400, the minimum before, or 4,000, and now it's gotten down to about a little over 2,000 per day, kWh. We've adjusted for this to account for the outside air temperature fluctuations when we did the MMV, or measurements and verification. This is for the natural gas analysis. Again, we did an MMV. We had, prior to the metering, real-time metering of the building, we did a two-year monthly consumption reading of the building. And on average, it's about 700 therms per day, per hour, right here. And so after the commissioning project was done, we were able to modulate or regulate the use of gas in the building, ranging from about below 6, and it goes down to about half therms per hour. Okay, what are the lessons learned? We focus mainly on mechanical areas, but also spend time looking at zones, which where we have VAV boxes. And what we found out, the temperature sensors in some of the areas were kind of situated at the areas where it's between the conditioned space and a space that are not. So you have that mixing of temperatures. So we relocated those sensors in order to get a better reading for those temperature locations. Some of the things that happen with the incorrect location is you've got this excessive cooling going on for those areas. The building engineer is a very good resource person on talking or finding out what the historical problems are in the building, so we were able to address those. And then, again, we have to go back and do some VAV tuning. And for those who are interested, for gas metering, you can do a real-time pulse output to your EMS. You can contact your local utility. For this program here, we're able to do that with PG&E. It's about $1,500 for them to do the pulse output connected to our EMS. Okay, next steps, we're going to be closely working with our commissioning agent, Quest, to find out more potential projects. Although the commissioning project is done, we'll be able to do more additional measures and implement that this year. And finally, we are working closely with the control system, air systems. We installed our automated geologic controls to develop more screens and monitoring and maybe a tool to keep the persistence level of the commissioning project going on. And that's my presentation. Thank you.
Harry West Gym, similar to Cal State San Bernardino's project, this was completed 4 or 5 years ago, and it turns out that the design intent for lighting was inadequate. And so here we are having a building where we now need to think about a lighting retrofit 4 years after we accepted it. So, in consistency with the AIA learning objectives, you're going to learn a little bit about how to correct lighting illumination deficiencies through daylighting or daylight harvesting and energy efficient lighting today. But this project is at San Diego City College, which is in downtown San Diego. Beautiful location. We're proud of it. It's been around almost 100 years. The Harry West Gym is shown here on this particular photo, but we have room for up to 2,000 spectators. We host a number of basketball and volleyball and badminton tournaments. I guess City College is the 3-time reigning badminton champion in the state of California, if you're interested. So, but anyhow, this is the existing condition that we inherited, and you can see that these are light readings and foot candles. We have 3 courts within the gym, but the one on the left here, you'll see that we're looking at single-digit foot candles here, and in general terms, they're as low as 4.4 foot candles there, mid-court, left center. And, you know, they get a little bit better as we move towards the north court, but, you know, the best that we're doing is about 49 foot candles, significantly less than what's typically required for collegiate athletics. So what do we do about this? We looked at various options. I mean, obviously, you could replace the HID lighting with something else and just double what you have, and you could, you know, double your energy consumption and deal with the problem that way. But what we looked at is there's a daylight harvesting technology. Daylight Inside is the name of the company that assisted us here. But replacing the HIDs with T5 fixtures and these daylight harvesting skylights. Well, this shows you in general terms where the skylights were going to be placed and various readings that you see there in red. But we're replacing 4,750-watt HID fixtures with the T5s and then the 20 daylight harvesting fixtures, which are the skylights. And bottom line is over 116,000 kilowatt hours saved on an annual basis. Now, that translates into our current consumption rates with San Diego Gas and Electric, about $17,000-$18,000 a year. It's not insignificant. The big driver behind this was really getting our lighting levels to the point where we could host collegiate tournaments. That was a very big deal for our dean of athletics. Some of the other advantages, ultimately this $12,000 in incentives, we've just recently recalculated that, and that's almost double what we anticipated when we put this presentation together. So we began this back in November 2008, and this kind of shows you what the existing conditions were with the HIDs here in the lower portion. And this is what the installation looked like on the metal seam roof up above. You can see in the lower right-hand corner that we actually water tested everything. Any of you in facilities know that whenever you make penetrations in the roofs, we tend to have problems. And so we at least wanted to make certain that we didn't have any problems from the get-go with this particular application. And you can see we're right literally downtown San Diego. So energy savings, this particular table shows you what we would have consumed with the 750-watt HIDs if we'd used that as our alternative to solve our illumination problem versus what the T5s would consume. And you can see that there's roughly a $17,000 difference on an annual basis, and that's assuming $15 per kWh. We're not looking at the impacts on demand charges and other things, just very simply. So we saw this earlier. This was the pre-existing condition. And we went back after we put in the daylight harvesting fixtures, and what were single digits, you can now see are all well into the double digits. Center court were about 100, as high as 114-foot candles, just with natural daylight. Pretty significant. And that's a big deal, even on a gray, cloudy day like we have here in Santa Barbara, which we have frequently in San Diego this time of year. We're still getting adequate illumination levels. So what happens at nighttime? Well, basically that's when we fire up our T5s, and you can see the illumination levels there are on the order of 50-foot candles or higher, which is quite good. This was just a quick comparison slide, but you can see here in the pre-existing, whoever prepared this doesn't understand the significant digits, but aside from that, we looked at 18-foot candles on the pre-existing condition to 76 for the daylight harvesting mode, and then 54 when we're using the T5 fixtures. So pretty significant change. I mean, basically we're tripling the lighting with the T5s over the existing condition, and even doing even better with the daylighting. So, quickly, what did it cost us? $105,000. We did get some HID rebates from San Diego Gas and Electric, as well as the KWH saved. So, about $11,000. Subsequently, we've recalculated that. It's more like $21,000. That 5 cents per kilowatt hour has gone up rather significantly with their new incentive program. So, the net cost to us was $93,000. And if you look at that, here's basically an analysis on your return on investment. This one actually includes depreciation, which doesn't apply to most of us here in this room. But bottom line, simple rate of return, 3.98 years. So essentially four-year rate of return from a simple perspective on this, and addressed our needs for illumination. Now, from a sustainability perspective, what does this mean? Well, by using daylight harvesting, we're essentially reducing 261,000 pounds of carbon dioxide emission on an annual basis. Okay, well, that's a big number. What does that mean? Well, that's equivalent to 22 cars off the San Diego freeway. I think this is actually a photo from L.A., but nevertheless, we do have our traffic problems down in San Diego. So we'll answer questions if you have any towards the tail end.
All right. Good morning, everybody. Hopefully you were able to attend the conference at Cal Poly last year that we hosted in 2008. This is a photo of the old campus. Those buildings no longer exist, but it really used to be just a farm in the middle of the open fields, some of our original buildings. Founded in 1901. Obviously, we have multiple eras of construction, variety of technologies. We've gone through many changes over the years. The last major lighting retrofit was in 2001, where we finally got rid of pretty much the last of our T12s and magnetic ballasts and PCBs. And the technology has changed enough that we're ready to take a fresh look at our lighting systems and do some big retrofits again. In preparation for the conference last year, we worked with the peer program to implement these technology demonstration programs, a number of different technologies, used them for the walking tours for the conference. And I'd like to recognize and thank Wes Morgan, formerly from the CLTC, now working for us, for the good guys at CSU. As well as Corey Jackson from CLTC, and of course the peer program. One other thing we did was to make sure to put all those folks in contact with our ESCO that was working on our campus-wide energy audit to educate those folks, our consultants, about these latest technologies and look for opportunities to implement them. So the first one, this is pretty easy, low-hanging fruit. If you haven't done this, you really should. Smart bi-level stairwell fixtures. You'd be amazed how little time of the day your stairwells are occupied, especially in an academic setting where you have a cyclical traffic pattern in the buildings following the class schedules from the, I like to refer to it as the hourly migration from on the hour to 10 after, whatever your campus schedule is. Estimated up to 95% of the day, there's nobody in the stairs. Of course, we have to keep them lit for safety, for egress purposes, but we don't have to keep them lit at maximum level all the time. So this is a product available on the market, integrated motion sensors built into the fixture, integrated dimming ballast. Each one is standalone, so you don't have to rewire your system. It's simply a fixture replacement. They have emergency fixtures available, so they have battery backup built in. And very simple. They use ultrasonic motion sensing technology, so it works well in interior stairwells. Exterior stairwells need to be a little careful on because they can be sensitive to air movement and wind. They dim down to 20% output when the stairwell is not occupied and immediately ramp up to full output when somebody opens a door and steps into the stairwell. The M&V on this portion of our project indicated an energy savings, a net energy savings of approximately 90% against our baseline. In our office building, both in the private offices and in our conference rooms, we had these throughout, a variety of 2, 3, and 4 lamp fixtures in 32-watt T8s. And the glare was so bad that we had multiple people with glare screens on their monitors, on their PCs. Some people could be seen wearing visors at their workstation. Many people had taken to performing some amateur electrical work and delamping their own fixtures or cutting out manila folders to kind of block light. It was really horrible. So we looked for an opportunity to redo this completely, do a bit of a lighting redesign as part of the integrated office lighting system. We figured we were using an average of about 110 watts per fixture. We retrofit these using the Lithonia RT5 retrofit kit. We got turned onto these by our colleagues at the Long Beach campus, had used this as their campus standard and gone T5 campus-wide. We weren't really convinced we wanted to move to T5, but at the time, Lithonia wasn't making this fixture in a T8. They do now. That is becoming our campus standards. Is this the Lithonia RT8 fixture? Same troffer style, same reflector, same lens, but in a T8 lamp. So with the T5 retrofit, we put those in a number of our offices. We moved our color temperature from 3500K to 4100K, a little brighter, wider light. These came with a step dimming ballast. Many of the offices we found were able to run at the low setting permanently at 50% output. So we went from about 110 watts per fixture down to about 34 watts per fixture. The Lithonia refers to this fixture as a volumetric fixture. The way they have designed it for light distribution, the performance is amazing. You go from these things shooting straight down to these, and I wish I had some better photos to show you, but the lighting distribution, the evenness around the room, the lighting of the walls was night and day different. The higher color temperatures, of course, result in a higher perceived light level. It's better for our older eyes, and like I said, the RT8 is going to be our campus standard. Also, as part of the integrated office lighting system, and thank you, CLT, I stole some of your photos, because our desks aren't nearly this organized. So as part of the integrated office lighting system, the general philosophy is to reduce your overhead lighting and bring light to the task plane where you need it, where you're working. So we use the FineLight PLS, or personal lighting system. It's a suite of three different wattages of desk lamps and under cabinet LED lamps. These are all LED. The 6 watters, there's 6, 9, and 12 watts. The 6 watters turned out to work for almost everybody. A few 9s, I don't think we needed to use any of the 12s. They were extremely popular. In fact, we had a few spaces where we installed these, and I literally installed these in maybe 10 minutes per office at the most. If people were gone on vacation, the next day their PLS was gone and it was in somebody else's office. They're extremely, extremely popular. So, in fact, a number of the folks in our office don't use their overhead lights at all, myself included, and we just work strictly with the LED lights. So I went from roughly 100 watts in my office down to a total of about 12. Also, as part of this, you wouldn't see it in the picture, but on the floor or on the wall, you'd have a little power supply, a little DC power supply that plugs into the wall, has ports for every fixture to plug into to supply them, as well as a little phone jack to go to a motion sensor, passive infrared motion sensor that mounts underneath your desk. And when you step out of the office in a few minutes, your desk lights will go off automatically, as well as your overhead lights. Great system. The total package, the overhead lighting retrofit and the PLS, reduced our office lighting energy by about 80%. So we also implemented some integrated classroom lighting demonstration projects, a couple of different locations. And the general approach, we were using a FineLight product, is to go from your plain old flush mount fluorescent wrap fixtures to a pendant mounted fixture with an uplight and downlight component. For the teaching environment, you have a number of operating modes. So you have a separate circuit for your lights in front of the projector screen or whiteboard fixture. They integrate dual technology motion sensors that include both ultrasonic and passive infrared to turn the lights off when nobody's in the room. And lots of controllability for the occupants for different teaching modes. So these pictures represent general instruction mode with all the lights on, the down lights and the up lights on. And this would be an AV mode with the up lights turned off, down light only, and the whiteboard light turned off so they can see the digital projection screen clearly. So there was also a teacher control panel at the front of the room with switches so the teacher has full control without having to leave the teaching space at the front to change modes. The two projects we implemented, one of them was used for the conference, and a great lesson learned. We had to paint that room first. Paint has an amazing impact on the way your lighting looks. So we took kind of a dingy old room and put a nice coat of fresh white paint on it. The lighting was really improved. We implemented this in a large auditorium classroom. That system, we used the direct indirect pendant mounted fixture with separate whiteboard fixture control, teaching mode and AV mode. That project, without dimming capability, just having the couple of lighting modes and the motion sensing technology, resulted in an energy reduction of about 50%. We also implemented the ICLS in a more challenging room. This is one of our conference rooms in our facility management building with a very low ceiling. That's about an 8-foot ceiling at the most. You wouldn't think you could do pendant mounted fixtures in there, but we did, and it worked quite well. This is during construction. You can see some of the ceiling flush mount wrap fixtures are still there, had not been removed yet. I think we took out a total of 16 32-watt lamps, replaced them with a total of 10. And we also got rid of, in the center of the room where these pendant mounted fixtures are, there was a row of flood spots that were used for different presentation lighting modes. So we got rid of quite a bit of lighting. And typically when we have meetings in this room now, we run the little dimmer controls right over here on the wall. It's rarely above 50%. And when we have meetings in there where we have to use the projection screen, even without having separate whiteboard fixtures, we just dim it down a little bit and get wonderful lighting in the room. The lighting energy for this particular room was reduced by 30% with this system. We also did a little bit of streetlight work, a blend of different technologies. So again, in front of Cerro Vista, there's an example of some LED streetlights. We did both LED and HID smart dimmable fixtures. So you have a motion sensor on the pole detecting motion going by. Obviously, this would not be appropriate for street lights for traffic use with cars going by at 30 miles an hour. The motion sensing doesn't really make sense. But for pedestrian walkways, parking lots, it's very applicable technology. So we replaced some 100-watt HPS shoebox lights with this mix of a little bit of LED and a little bit of HID. The LEDs are an 80-watt fixture that dim down to 35% output when no motion is detected. Those resulted, I didn't put the energy, oh, there we go, 50%, I got them mixed up, 50 and 40% energy savings net between the two systems. Both result in a major improvement to color rendition. So, of course, the HPS fixtures, high-pressure sodium, give you that, you know, somebody has to call the cops to report an incident, and it was a guy wearing a brown sweatshirt in a brown car with brown pants. Everything is kind of that reddish-brown color at night. The color rendition is significantly improved here. I'll show you a nice slide about that in just a minute. So from the M&V, this was kind of interesting to look at in front of the dorms. You know, these are catching a major pedestrian walkway here for the students returning to their dorms after classes or at the end of the night, going to the library or, you know, looking at the behavior patterns here. You see a lot of activity during the day. And we get to midnight, the students are still studying hard, kind of wrapping things up. So you can see kind of a little bit of the cyclical nature of the hour-long cycles. And then we have things winding down, and then right after 2 a.m., have another little burst of activity at 2 a.m. I'm sure they're coming home from the library, right? And finally they're all in bed, and you get great reduction at night with no activity. But, of course, it's the area under the curve, right, is your total energy. So there's a lot of short periods when the light is reduced and some nice chunks here where it's down for a number of hours. So both of these technologies reduced our net energy by 40 to 50%. Okay, lessons learned. So Wes tried his best to teach me as a dumb mechanical engineer about lighting technology and the difference between scotopic and photopic light. And those are great short words that mean a lot of stuff. But this diagram over here is a great representation of it. So these photos are of the same vehicles parked in the same spot in the same parking lot before and after a retrofit to LED. So look at the lighting with high-pressure sodium lights, 300 watts per fixture, 21,000 lumens with a color rendition index of 22, very low, very poor. Compare that to an LED system with less than half the wattage, a little over a third of the total lumen output, but a much higher color rendition index of 75, almost performing with indoor fluorescent light. You know, which one of those parking lots would you rather have your daughter walk into the car by herself in? It's pretty clear. So what this is having to do is the difference in the way the human eye perceives light intensity or lumens and color rendition. So in fact, color rendition can be more important than light output. So wherever you have a chance to raise your color temperature, and especially on exterior lights, look at induction technology, look at LED technology. The lighting improvement is enormous. What you need to be careful of, though, is that the color temperature is so different, you don't want to mix them, either within a building or between a street and a parking lot. That's kind of upsetting to the eye to have a drastic change in color temperature. The eye doesn't receive that well. In fact, in our own building, we weren't able to retrofit every single space, so we had some offices with 4100K, some with 3500K, and it was bothersome. People complained about the light being bluish because of that change of walking from the yellowish orangish 3500K hallways into an office with 4100K. So when you change them all. LEDs can have a very bright source. You know, the LEDs are very intense, can be perceived as a little harsh. The street lights that we implemented, when you walk by, it's kind of like these spots. They're so harsh, they're a bit of a glare. So I think on our campus, we're probably going to be looking more toward the induction technology. It's a little bit cheaper upfront cost with almost the same energy savings as LED. LEDs, you have to be careful. They claim very long lamp lives, but it's not the lamp that's going to fail first. It's going to be the driver, the power supply. So be careful to look into the quality of the materials you're looking at. And control of heat rejection is critical to life of LEDs. Again, smart bi-level technologies aren't going to give you a lot of help in high traffic areas because you're not going to have enough downtime. So take that into consideration. And with any project, outreach and education to the folks that are going to be impacted is critical beforehand. So, for instance, talking to our housing folks and our university police was a big part for us. And there's credits and references. So thank you very much.
The first thing that people think about is the energy savings. And what we started with was, how much of our energy is going to lighting on the campus? We are a pretty large campus. We use 250 million kilowatt hours per year. And I wanted to get a sense of our lighting, how much of the lighting was represented in that energy. Turns out it's about 58 million kilowatt hours a year for lighting sources, interior, exterior combined. And just focusing on the exterior, we have our parking lots, roads, pathways. Separate category are all the wall packs that are attached to the exterior buildings, but this piece alone is about 6.5 million kilowatt hours a year, and that's what I'm going to talk about this morning. We're tackling that piece. Again, energy is the first thing that comes to mind. Everyone's interested in the energy savings, which has the corresponding CO2 emission reductions for sustainability, but what really is what made this go wasn't the energy savings initially. What sort of piqued my curiosity was driving to our campus, and has anyone been to UC Davis? So a number of you have, and if you've driven by on Highway 80, we have a beautiful Mondavi Performing Arts Center, and it's a very new and attractive area. Right to the south of it, butting up to the freeway, is a huge surface parking lot, and if you're driving home in the winter or early in the morning hours, you go past, and there are hundreds and hundreds of lights on, and no cars, no people in sight. So doing that day after day, it just sort of bothered me. And I thought, that, you know, this doesn't look good. Here's one of the premier higher education institutes in the world, and people were coming by and must be scratching their heads. Why are the lights on? There's no one here. So I was lucky enough to stumble into the Lighting Technology Center, where I met Michael Siminovich, who's the director, Wes Morgan, Corey Jackson, and a host of other really bright and talented folks. And we just started talking about what our commonalities were, what were my perceived problems, what were they working on, and it led to this notion of the bi-level. What was fun about it, it wasn't necessarily developing any new widget that didn't exist before. It was taking a lot of products and ideas and technologies that existed and combining them and improving upon them to produce a more reliable and robust system. And really the benefits were, as you can see, we were interested in safety. One of the first things I did was to enlist our campus police chief and our transportation and parking services director. We knew we needed to get their buy-in and wanted to have them not just buy in at the end, but be collaborative, develop ideas along the way so we didn't waste any time and knew that we were on the right track. Energy savings is obvious. The other piece, I'm on the O&M side of the house, so maintenance is a big deal for me. I have three people that are dedicated to exterior lighting for a 5,300-acre campus. We have over 4,000 lights on poles, about the same number attached to the building exteriors. So we have a lot of lights and not too many people to take care of them. So when we look at lamp changes every year and a half to 2 years, that gets to be troublesome both from a manpower standpoint and also from the campus's standpoint in terms of reliability, risk, and maintaining a well-lit environment. The public image piece was the first thing I talked about, driving past and seeing lights on when no one's making any beneficial use of that energy. And the lighting quality, which Dennis has spoken to, we were very interested in going from that the low CRI, high pressure sodium environment, the orange haze that the students would always comment on when we did surveys, to the higher CRI of the metal halides, the LEDs, the induction fixtures, where you can tell the silver car from the gold car and the brown pants and all those things. So they were also attributes that the police were interested in terms of being able to identify someone who was a perpetrator of a crime, better identifying them, and the other point that Dennis made about the awareness with bi-level technology of increasing and decreasing the lighting levels is a sort of a natural. What I've done is instead of a lot of bullets and things, I'll just have some photographs of what we've done and what they look like. This is our north entry parking structure. This is when we're in our demonstration phase. This is one of the first bi-level induction fixtures that was installed. Over here you can see one of the 175 high-pressure sodium fixtures. The ones that were out here, we have perimeter sensing on everything, so those are off. And this is a 150-watt metal halide in its last stages of life. This is one of our electricians installing the first generation. They were very easy to install. This large sensor, this is the first generation, looks like a giant hockey puck, and the latest incarnation is about a fifth of that size, and it's been improved. We had a great relationship with the CLTC and basically access to the vendor and working on everything from the size of this, the reliability of this, and some of the internal circuits to being out there when the contractors are doing the installation or our folks and understanding what could be done to make this more plug and play. And there were quite a few things that were identified in that process to basically speed up the installation. This is that north entry structure during construction, the installation. And you can see these are the new induction lights with the higher CRI. These are the HPS, and the picture speaks for itself. This is a nice one of that same structure, lower level. And again, side by side, you can see the HPS environment and the clean, bright induction environment we have over there. That's another level. People came in afterwards and they wanted to know, did we paint the structure? Did we clean it? What did we do? It was so bright. They just couldn't believe it. It was the same place. And we went in. These are 100-watt fixtures. And actually, the manufacturer, same one that Dennis referred to, they've got improved optics. So with our next go-around, we'll be doing about 900 more of these in the next couple of months, and they'll be 70-watt fixtures. This is another installation we did. We wanted to sort of dip our toe in the LED pond, and we were pretty careful about what we selected. We wanted something that was reliable. I was getting phone calls, emails, all kinds of solicitations from everybody and their brother who was making some kind of an LED fixture from China, Taiwan, or Timbuktu. And that's where we relied on the CLTC to really filter and sort out the wheat from the chaff. These are very expensive. We did about 50 of them on top of this parking structure in that performing arts area. The aesthetics were a consideration there. We did want to try LED. And the other benefit was the fixture that had been here before was almost a flood fixture that was adapted for the use for parking. And from the freeway, it was just a huge, huge glare bomb. These are full cutoff, so when you're in the area, it's very nicely lit. But before, all of this would have been illuminated, and you could have seen this like it was daylight. So we have a pretty nice distribution of lighting. There's somewhat hot spots and dark spots, but nothing near what it was before. And again, we're looking at hopefully 100,000-hour lamp life, so rather than every 2 years, maybe every 12 years we'll be changing lamps, and we still have to address ballasts and the other components. But it turned out very nicely, and it's a very high-profile area for the campus. We delved into some other things. We currently have about 20 of these up on the north entry of our campus. This is a full cutoff Cobra fixture. It's induction. It's not bi-level. We're not ready to go that way on roadways yet, but we do have some that we'll install in parking lots, similar to the one that Dennis showed at Cal Poly. This is one of the earlier demonstrations just to show that we also tried this with a number of HID fixtures. This was a metal halide, and it generally works. We ran into some issues with certain lamps don't like to really work in the horizontal orientation. And we had problems in one of the demonstration lots where the lights just wouldn't work, and it was a matter of trial and error working with the Lang Technology folks where we came to understand that it was actually a different type of bulb that needed to be spec'd. That's all I had, other than throwing out a couple of factoids about the differences in the energy consumption. We're basically looking at 100-watt fixtures that are, the combined fixture is about 110 watts with lamp and ballast, and that's replacing a 138-watt system. And that's just the reduction you get from replacing the technology. Then with the bi-level component, we found that for the parking structures, using data loggers and metering, that those lights are typically on in the high mode about 40% of the time now, and 60% of the time off hours, they're down at 50% lighting. And for the surface lots, it's about a 55-45 split between high mode and low mode. So in addition to that approximate 15-20% savings just on the output, add the bi-level component, and you're in anywhere from 40-70% combined for the system. So it's truly a good savings. It provides a lot of benefits. I think there are more benefits than just the energy savings. And the current build-out that we're involved with is going to be about $1 million. It's going to save a projected 1.25 million kilowatt hours a year. So if you took that at 10 cents, you can do that math pretty easily and see what the savings are. Anywhere from 7 to 11 years, simple payback just on the energy. If you throw in maintenance savings and some of the other intangibles, you're probably down in the 6 to 7 year range without much trouble. So back to Artie.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.